The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I believe what we're calling a dust-up, but has had some fairly serious consequences, which is, includes the expelling of our ambassador, the bringing of kind of end to all new investment, although we're still, I think, trying to figure out what the scale of that actually means. Unfortunately, Saudi students who are in Canada are being forced to leave and return back to their country, so that's unfortunate for Canadian universities as well as those students. And even going so far as to force Saudi patients who are getting medical treatment in Canada back to Saudi Arabia as well. So they're taking this fairly seriously, to put it mildly.
I'm Shannon Tagawa Mercer, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 13th, 2018. Canada and Saudi Arabia have been at loggerheads over the past week and change. About what, you ask? The Canadian Foreign Minister tweeted condemnation of Saudi Arabia's arrest of Samer Badawi, a human rights activist. Since that tweet, we've seen extreme responses from Saudi Arabia, including expelling the Canadian ambassador to Saudi Arabia, halting trade negotiations, and the pulling of the Saudi Arabian ambassador for diplomatic consultation. To sort this all out, I spoke to Scott Anderson, former diplomat and international lawyer, and Canadian professors Stephanie Carvin of the Intrepid podcast and Carleton University, Besma Momani of the Stimson Center, and Thomas Juno of the University of Ottawa. I asked them about Saudi Arabian and Canadian strategy. I asked them about international legal considerations. And I asked them about what comes next. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 338, A Worthwhile Canadian Dust-Up. We have on the podcast today some old friends of Lawfare and some new friends of Lawfare to discuss what's going on between Canada and Saudi Arabia. And first, if you listen to Rational Security or if you followed Lawfare for a long time, you know that there is a baker of hard national security choices. And I wanted to pose this question to our guest today, but I wonder, Steph, do you know this baker?
Well, on behalf of Canada, I can definitely say we can neither confirm nor deny the identity of the baker of hard national security choices. But clearly, whoever that person is a genius. So we should just recognize that right away.
Well, whether this person is currently present on the podcast or not, we thank this person for their baking service. On to the serious topic for today. As many of us know, and we've seen in the news, there's been a bizarre exchange between Canada and Saudi Arabia this week. So Stephanie, I was wondering if you could walk us through what's happening.
Well, really, it was a long weekend for us in Canada. And, you know, so I think many Canadians are probably gathered around their barbecues, our moose pits, our beaver catching games, those kinds of things. And really, this kind of took us all aback because it seems that the Saudi government was reacting to very, very strongly, as it's the point of this podcast, to a tweet that was sent out by our foreign ministry that was effectively condemning the arrest of Saudi activists who have been protesting or demanding certain human rights in Saudi Arabia, including Samer Badawi, who is the sister of Raif Badawi, who's been arrested, I believe, since 2012. And so Canada has taken an interest in this case. Raif Badawi's wife is now a Canadian citizen. She lives in Quebec and has been lobbying pretty hard for the Canadian government to take a stance. So apparently this tweet was seen as some kind of insidious invasion of Saudi sovereignty by Canada and is now basically resulted in this, I believe what we're calling a dust up, but has had some fairly serious consequences, which is, includes the expelling of our ambassador, the bringing of kind of end to all new investment, although we're still, I think, trying to figure out what the scale of that actually means. Unfortunately, Saudi students who are in Canada are being forced to leave and return back to their country. So that's unfortunate for Canadian universities as well as those students. And even going so far as to force Saudi patients who are getting medical treatment in Canada back to Saudi Arabia as well. So they're taking this fairly seriously, to put it mildly. And I think a lot of us are still kind of scratching our heads at why this has been such a strong reaction, although I'm sure we can parcel some of that out in today's podcast.
Over the course of these responses, how has Canada responded? What's their official stance?
In my view, I think the Canadian government is doing its best to essentially downplay this as much as possible. They're standing by what they've said, but Canada isn't, you know, we're not known for really escalating things. We're not big into one-upmanship for a variety of reasons. But, you know, whether it's with Donald Trump or Saudi Arabia, we usually say we will meet, whether it's tariffs or whether it's measures, we will meet those challenges, but we don't like to exceed them. So I think what's going to happen is you will not see the Canadian government back down, but you will see, I think, an attempt eventually to reach out to Saudi Arabia, probably through one of our European allies. Although in the past, this has not been something that, you know, this would have been something that we would have actually probably asked the United States to help us with. But it doesn't seem that something that the Trump administration is going to be too eager to do.
Sure. So before digging into the Canadian strategy, Saudi Arabian strategy and the U.S. perspective, I'm going to turn to Scott and ask him, what are the international law issues or diplomatic protocol issues that have arisen?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we've seen Saudi Arabia do here is what's something that's called PNGing, which is a verb of sorts in the diplomatic world, which refers to persona non grata. And that's a status that certain countries are allowed to impose on foreign diplomats under the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, Article 9. Essentially, what this means is that at any point, a host government can choose to expel foreign diplomats. Under Article 9 of the VCDR, they are not required to give a justification. They are not required to have a reason. It is really at their discretion. And this is based on the kind of the premise that foreign diplomats are there at the invitation, at the grace of the host government. That said, you know, usually this is used as a sign of displeasure or on occasions where the diplomat or the other government has done something wrong in some regards. Often if there's an example of criminal activity or severe activity of kind of political interference. A classic example is after 2016, the Obama administration expelled several Russian diplomats under PNG for interference in U.S. elections. We saw the same thing happen earlier this year with more Russian diplomats. Where they were for alleged involvement in intelligence activities and in response to the use of chemical agents against two individuals in the United Kingdom. And so it's this kind of a very powerful tool that is sanctioned under international law. What's interesting here is the justification that the Saudi government has given for this action, where essentially they said the Canadians are interfering in Saudi internal affairs and domestic affairs. And this hits at a tension in between this principle of the diplomatic role and the host government. International law embraces ideas of sovereignty. It embraces ideas of independence. And it accepts the idea that there are certain issues that are a state's domestic internal affairs. And you see this in Article 2 of the UN Charter. You see this in Article 41 of the Vienna Convention, which again actually obligates diplomats not to interfere in the internal relations or internal affairs of their host government. But there's a tension there in that, of course, it's diplomats' jobs, and the VCDR codifies that embassies and diplomats are allowed to engage foreign governments on their foreign policy, to discuss their foreign policy, track developments, and do a lot of actions that some would say may border on interference. And there's this gray area between these two spheres where they conflict, where they're both really norms. It's not clear that there's an international law obligation not to engage in this sort of criticism. But a lot of countries, and particularly when it comes to human rights criticism, a lot of countries say that there's somehow a violation of an international law norm. And we see Saudi Arabia evoking those same ideas here, and then taking the very strong signal of expelling an ambassador, what is a pretty severe step, usually for a pretty severe repercussion. We also saw Saudi Arabia here call their own ambassador to Canada back for consultations. It's another step in this diplomatic dance, another discretionary action that Canada can do to pull people back. What's interesting, though, is that we haven't, to my knowledge, although our guests, other guests may correct me on this, to our knowledge, we haven't seen Saudi Arabia claim a right to take any steps that would be violative or not permitted under existing international agreements. If they were to do so, for instance, trade agreements or other sorts of agreements, they would be implying that somehow Canada has violated international law norm and they would be applying countermeasures. There's an idea about there are certain circumstances in which you can violate another country's your international legal obligations towards another country as a kind of response to those sorts of measures. We haven't seen them do that. Instead, we're seeing them focus on these sorts of discretionary actions, which I think tells us a little bit how they think about this, that from an international law perspective, we're not at the point of any violation of international legal obligations. We're in this realm of discretionary conduct between Canada and Saudi Arabia.
So this realm of discretionary conduct seems to have been rooted in the violation of some dignitary interest, right? Like this tweet set something off in Saudi Arabia. I'd like to understand that a little bit more. So I'm going to turn to Besma and Thomas. Besma, would you mind starting us off with some background on the human rights issue that was brought up with the Canadian Foreign Ministry's tweet?
Yeah, so as Stephanie pointed out, the Badawi family, which has some weak links to Canada, I do want to point out the Samar Badawi, who is the sister of Raif Badawi, both are Saudi citizens who have been arrested. They're both activists. Raif talks about secularism and liberalism, and his sister about women's rights, both arrested. Raif's wife obtained citizenship here in Canada and lives in Quebec. And so they've sort of made a very passionate case for releasing Raif Badawi in an attempt to sort of reunite him with his family. So this certainly start off with Mr. Freeland, our Minister of Foreign Affairs, asking for the release. I'd point out that, you know, they've sent similar types of tweets before. There's nothing new in terms of the content of what the Canadian government has been arguing for, particularly under this government, for some time now. I think this is really an important point, is that it's not new to focus on this family. But certainly the reaction of the Saudis has been definitely strange and over the top.
So what you're saying is that the policy that Canada is advocating for publicly now isn't really a new policy. So what must have happened within Saudi Arabia, Thomas? Do you have some perspective on what might have made them respond now?
No, I think Besma is correct to point out that the tweets themselves were absolutely normal. There was nothing special to them. They were the catalyst of everything that happened, but they were not actually the cause. When thinking about why all of this happened, I think there's three broad reasons that we can identify. The first one is a bit of background on Canada-Saudi Arabia relations per se. Canada-Saudi relations over the years have been cordial. They've been positive without being excessively warm, but they've been limited. But over the last couple of years, a fair bit of tension had accumulated between the two countries. And to make a long story short, 4 years ago, Saudi Arabia bought for $15 billion Canadian dollars of light armored vehicles. Saudi Arabia doesn't buy big packages of military kit like that because it actually needs them. It's more an investment in the relationship. So in exchange for that, Saudi expected Canada to deepen the partnership at the trade level, but also, you know, scientific and cultural exchanges and things like that. And back then, under the previous conservative government, Canada was keen to do that. 2015, the Liberals and Justin Trudeau win power. They're also keen to do that. But the LAV deal, the light armored vehicle deal, just proved too controversial for the Liberals. And throughout 2016 and 2017, the Liberals basically decided to mostly freeze relations with Saudi Arabia, because anytime they tried to do something publicly, the criticism from the media, from civil society, was just too controversial. So as relations really froze between the two countries, Saudi Arabia grew increasingly irritated and quite frustrated. So that's really reason number one. Reason number two why all of this happened, I think it has to be seen as consistent with a broad pattern of Saudi assertiveness and impulsiveness in foreign policy. Look at the blockade of Qatar, look at the war in Yemen. I mean, remember that this is a country that late last year basically took the Lebanese prime minister hostage for a couple of days. So that what Saudi's been doing to Canada for 4 days now, 5 days, is really consistent with that pattern. And the third final reason I think that explains why and how this has happened is President Trump. I don't think it's fair to blame him or to say that there was any kind of conspiracy between Saudi and the U.S. I don't think that's true. That being said, by President Trump being so dismissive of human rights and so clearly being friendly with autocrats like Saudi Arabia and others, and signaling that he is not not really bothered by human rights abuses. This gives a license for middle powers like Saudi Arabia, revisionist powers, who already have a bit of a reckless bent, to act even more recklessly. So if you put these three factors together, I think that explains how the tweets on their own provoked all of this.
Speaking of autocrats and personalities, I haven't yet, or we haven't yet, discussed Mohammed bin Salman. Does he specifically, as a new leader in Saudi Arabia, have a role to play in this?
I think he absolutely does. I think, when King Salman took the throne in early 2015, he provoked the emergence of his son, Mohammed bin Salman. And even though MBS is really, now that he's crown prince, he's really the face of the Saudi regime, of the kingdom, his father is not a figurehead. And things, I'm convinced, do not happen without him acquiescing. Even though, there's an argument that MBS may be even more aggressive and ambitious than his father, I don't think he does things against his father's will.
Yeah, and I'll just jump in here. One thing that I think is really notable, again, is just that this measure, while it's not necessarily prohibited by international law, removing an ambassador, PNGing an ambassador, a foreign ambassador, and then recalling your own ambassador, these are pretty severe actions. These are things that are usually saved for majorly offensive, often criminal actions, either by foreign diplomats or foreign government. And so this sort of overreaction, I think, as Tom noted, it's a trend we've seen really particularly since MBS has started playing a more dominant role in Saudi foreign policy, again, in Lebanon, in Qatar, in all these other circumstances, in Yemen. I think, frankly, Saudi Arabia has very professional diplomats that are very familiar with the sort of signals that these send and proportionality, and hesitant to break these sorts of norms. And so I would be a little surprised if this were something that were generated by the people who are doing this for a living. It strikes me as somebody coming in who has these very bold views, wants to take decisive action, and has the power to implement it. And in my mind, like many of these other actions, the person most consistently in that position likely is MBS or somebody very close to him.
Besma, are there other things that we should be looking at within Saudi Arabian politics or even Middle Eastern regional politics that might help us understand the situation better?
Yeah, I mean, my assessment of things is that there's also quite a bit happening on the domestic front. In the past week, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman got quite a bit of flack from, regional media, from Arab intellectuals. I mean, we've seen this on the airwaves particularly in the region, really criticizing him for his attempt to support the Jared Kushner peace plan with regards to Israel-Palestine. And I think that maybe some of the rationale for why the tweet got sent out from the Saudi side may in fact be a reaction to what was happening at home, which was also a rebuke of the young crown prince by his father. King Salman, actually, in a very unorthodox move a few days ago, basically kind of stop the rumor mill that Mohammed bin Salman was, supporting the Jared Kushner peace plan, and in fact said, we do not, and we stand by the longstanding sort of traditional position of Saudi Arabia. And so, I mean, in the media, I would say, particularly in the Arab media, that was really interpreted as a rebuke of MBS, and people started saying, whoa, MBS is being reined in by his father now. So this is a man, as we all kind of dissected into a little bit of his psychology, likes to control the narrative. He likes to be in charge. And he's supported by a slew of really hyper-nationalistic young people now who see MBS as really kind of their savior, going to change their country in, 100 miles an hour. So I do feel that as though this is also a deflection from sort of bad press that he got. He's able to rile the base, so to speak. Kind of akin to what we see in U.S. domestic politics. He's riling the base. He's riling that hyper-nationalistic base who's now, all over Twitter, all over the social media, talking about how bold MBS is. And he's basically told the international community, speaking it to them and telling them, look, you've been preaching all these Western liberal values. Well, why don't you take a look at what's happening in your own backyard? Who are you to come and preach to us? I mean, there's still a strong anti kind of colonial sentiment throughout much of the Arab world for U.S. intervention. And I'll tell you, this plays really, really well, both at home and in the region abroad, to finally put the Western, countries in their place.
Those tactics certainly seem familiar to us on the U.S. side. So turning to the U.S., as both you and Thomas have mentioned, I'm going to ask Scott, what is the U.S. government doing? What must they be thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only real official response we've seen from the U.S. government so far has been a pretty milquetoast statement, essentially acknowledging that they're aware that this has happened, referring people to the Canadian-Saudi governments, encouraging Saudis to kind of take steps and abide by kind of due process issues in regards to underlying human rights cases. We saw slightly more disclosure, a slightly stronger statement from the State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert two or three days ago in responding after being pushed by journalists, said, well, in fact, we have talked to the Saudi government about this issue. You know, we do have these, there are concerns regarding the underlying case, but it's definitely been a much more quiet approach. And the U.S. government has come under criticism for this. Now, there's two sides of this. You know, this is not an entirely unfamiliar strategy for this region. You know, there is kind of an idea among a lot of people at the State Department that when dealing with particular issues that are high profile in this region, it's better to do it out of the public eye more directly, and that doing the otherwise can be escalate the situation a little bit. I think an interesting parallel here is in a 2014 incident in which the Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Rights, and Labor from the State Department, U.S. State Department, was expelled from Bahrain. And there we saw the United States issue stronger statements, but still not make as strong a public statement as one might expect, not trying to escalate the situation in public. But one can't imagine, has to imagine that there was a lot going on behind the scenes at that point. And in fact, we saw just a few months later, this same assistant secretary returned to Bahrain, be welcomed and said, I'm glad to be able to be here under better circumstances. Obviously, they had worked out something diplomatically to advance this. So it doesn't mean that there isn't anything happening beneath the surface through channels that we don't have evident to us, as the spokesperson Nauert alluded to. That said, as I believe Besma and Tom have alluded to, you know, we also have not seen really that many this administration be willing to push hard against the Saudis, particularly MBS. We know Jared Kushner supposedly has a relationship with MBS that they feel that they've crafted. We know they are looking to MBS for support about this Arab-Israeli peace plan that, in theory, they are supposed to be rolling out at some point in the near future, although that's constantly being pushed back and pushed back further. And frankly, a lot of this adventurism that we've seen MBS and the Saudis undertake since the entry into office of President Trump, you know, appears to imply that the Saudis at least believe that the Trumps are kind of giving them a lot of leeway to do what they want in their regional affairs. Now, we do know around the Hariri incident in Lebanon and a few other cases, there are reports that American diplomats were involved in trying to get them to moderate their position, roll back, certainly around the Qatar blockade. But these were actions that took place kind of after the fact when it escalated to a point where it really started threatening certain U.S. interests or just assorted other regional security interests. And so maybe if this were to continue to escalate, we may see Americans playing a more active role. Right now, it looks like they're raising the issue, they're expressing concern, and no doubt many members of the diplomatic community are. Again, this is a major departure from normal diplomatic protocol. But, you know, it's not clear that they're really making it a bilateral issue yet. Maybe they will in the future. I don't think we know.
There are lots of maybes about the future. Stephanie, can you help us American listeners understand what signs Canada may give off that would indicate escalation? I know you said that Canada isn't in the habit of escalating situations like this, but when should we be worried?
I have to think about how to answer that question, simply because, like I said, I think really, you know, Canada right now is in a situation where it can't afford to actually have a lot of enemies. In the end, you know, we're dealing with a Trump administration that has really kind of sucked a lot of the oxygen out of the room when it comes to our foreign policy. It's really, everything has been about the United States. And, you know, one of the major priorities for the Trudeau government right now has to be trade diversification, really. So, you know, I think this is why, you know, when I say we can't afford to escalate, this is why, is because we are not certain of what the NAFTA future is going to be. We don't know what trade with the United States is going to be. So we're looking for other partners. So for us to kind of, you know, my concern about this situation is we've effectively isolated ourselves from another part of the world. So rather than increasing trade with the Middle East, we might actually have to avoid that region for the near future. So that's one of the concerns I have. So again, I mean, I guess a real escalation would be in terms of speaking out more in human rights. To cancel the arms deal would be a massive step, but I don't really think there's going to be willingness to do this, especially since the Trudeau government has already put so much of its kind of credibility on the line to kind of keep that deal going, especially in the face of kind of opposition from domestic civil society here, who have expressed concerns that, you know, the arms, the light armored vehicles worth $15 billion that we're sending to Saudi Arabia are being used to commit human rights violations in the first place.
Besma and Thomas, I want to hear separately from the two of you, but this is related to what Stephanie's saying. What does Saudi Arabia want? What's their end game?
That's a great question. So my take on it, and of course, you know, we've been told, or at least what Adel Joubert, the foreign minister, said, is the Canadians know what needs to be done to fix the mistake. In my humble opinion, I think they want either the head of our foreign minister, or they want a formal apology, preferably, you know, Justin Trudeau getting on a plane and going to Riyadh. I mean, what they want is basically political suicide for any sovereign state and for any political party. So it's not going to happen. And I take that, you know, the reason why I suggest those two things is because of the way they've dealt with other crises. I mean, look at the diplomatic, standoff they have with Qatar. They've given them the most impossible list of demands, from shutting down Al Jazeera. And, you know, I mean, it's just incredible. That's the way they move, because they feel that they have so much economic heft, particularly this brash crown prince, to believe that they can get what they want.
And Thomas?
I think that more broadly, just to build on what Besma just said, that the message that Saudi Arabia wants to send is really not so much to Canada. I mean, Canada is collateral damage in this situation, as Besma and has said very well throughout the week. This is not about Canada primarily. It's about internal Saudi politics, as she said, but it's also about sending a message to others. It's about sending a message to European countries that criticism of the domestic situation in Saudi Arabia will come with the cost. Of course, I absolutely do not expect automatically to get the same reaction the next time a European country criticizes Saudi Arabia, because for Saudi Arabia, in this sense, Canada was an easy target. It was a convenient target because the relationship is fairly small. It comes at a low actual cost, strictly in terms of lost opportunities with the relationship. So do I expect Europeans to stop criticizing Saudi Arabia? Probably not. But clearly, the next time somebody thinks about in a European capitals, thinks about criticizing Saudi Arabia or saying something about the domestic situation there, this will be in the back of their minds. And even beyond European countries, I think this is consistent with the pattern of messages that Saudi Arabia has been sending throughout the region, not to Western countries that talk about human rights, but to Saudi Arabia's neighbors, both friendly ones and rivals. Toe the line. If you criticize us, if you oppose us, if you diverge from us, there will be a cost. And that it has clearly shown that so far, that it is its intention to impose that cost. Whether it actually does, it really depends on cases. But it's in that sense, I think we really have to understand this whole situation broader than Canada.
This is an open question to all of you. If that's the case, how do we think this is going to end? What are our predictions? Scott?
Well, sure. You know, I think what we just heard, I think, really gets at the heart of this, which is that, you know, Saudi Arabia has very unrealistic expectations about what's going to come out of this. And at least in my mind, frankly, they've painted themselves into a bit of a corner. They've had these very high profile diplomatic moves that, again, are going to be viewed by most of the international community as a pretty dramatic action. And the international community does, diplomatic community in particular, does have a record of having a little bit of solidarity, saying when somebody steps too far out of the line, exerting concerted pressure. Maybe the United States won't be in a leading role in that. Maybe they will. We don't know. But certainly, I think other governments will, at least on a quiet level, maybe not a public level. We also saw that the economic measures they're implementing, first and foremost, impact Saudis. We are going to have Saudi citizens who are going to die or not receive medical care because of these measures they're pursuing. We're going to see 12,000 Saudi students not being able to attend a school, may not be able to enroll in another school for this coming year because of these measures. Now, in this case, there's also an economic cost to Canada. That's certainly true. And we'll have to see what comes with these follow-on trade agreements. But there's going to be limits to how often they can do that. And imagine how Saudi citizens are going to react. It's bad enough they cut off to Canada's excellent schools and excellent hospitals. Imagine if they have to do the same for the United Kingdom and for France and for Germany and for European countries as well. Saudi Arabia just simply cannot pretend like it's going to install the sorts of repercussions to all the states that may criticize them. And the states that have taken statements like Canada include states like the United States. The United States 2018 Human Rights Report, which just came out this past April, says things very close along the lines of what Canada said here about Raif Badawi. And so the idea that this sort of criticism is going to stop entirely is, I think, in a long term, really sort of preposterous. And so in my mind, at least, I think what's most likely to happen is that Canada, I think, will do what it does well and often to its credit, which is exercise some restraint, wait for conditions to improve and let this blow over. And Saudi Arabia will ultimately have to recognize that they've kind of overplayed their hand and may be informed of that by some nation's other diplomats. And in that case, in the long run, hopefully they'll see a slow restoration of normalcy in this sort of relationship. You know, it's possible that we're going to see a little bit more escalation. We're going to see more of these responses. But I think that's really going to drive home just how weak the Saudis' position is on this in the long run.
Any other predictions or disagreements?
I would just say quickly that looking ahead, I see two things that matter. The first one is that it will be hard to walk this back. On the Saudi side, MBS has clearly shown that it is difficult for him to walk back. He partly walked back in Lebanon after he took hostage the Lebanese prime minister, but that was really so over the top that case was extreme. Qatar, Yemen, that is extremely costly to Saudi, and he's not walking back. In Canada, the confrontation is not costly for Saudi Arabia, or at least not very costly in a direct and narrow sense. So I don't expect him to walk back soon. And on the Canadian side, it will also be difficult to really openly adopt a conciliatory posture seeking, quote-unquote, reconciliation. You know, this is a government, the Trudeau government, that is left of center, that is trying to brand itself as progressive and feminist. So reconciliation with Saudi Arabia, of all countries, especially with a federal election 14 months away from now, so it is fast approaching, is going to be not impossible at all, but just a bit more costly. The other point I'd make about looking forward is the idea that just to build on what was just previously said, all of this in the bigger picture is counterproductive for Saudi Arabia. It's costly. I mean, one of the main priorities for Saudi Arabia right now is economic reform, the Vision 2030 blueprint and all of that. It is making some progress, not as much as MBS would want, but it is making some progress. One of the pillars of all of that is to brand Saudi Arabia as an attractive destination for foreign trade and investment. To do that, you need to show that your country is, you know, has predictable rules and you know, stable regulations and so on. Doesn't have to be necessarily democratic, but there's an element of predictability. Right now, MBS is showing the opposite in this case and in other cases. So more broadly, this is costly for Saudi Arabia. In the mid to longer term, the one actor that will suffer costs from this is not Canada. It's Saudi Arabia.
Besma, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, one thing that we didn't mention, but, you know, I hold dear the question of the students, 16,000 students and their families who are here. You know, I just keep hearing horror stories. Many of the Saudi students can't say anything about the fact that they're being ordered to come home right away. They are just, I mean, it is just depressing, the stories I can tell you of students who are like weeks away from defending their PhD and are told, come home now. I mean, these kinds of situations that people are in, and the Saudis are, of course, are saying, oh, it's easy. We'll find you a placement at another university. I mean, we're 2 weeks away from starting term, and that's just impossible. Not to mention, you know, with transfer credits and, you know, midstream trying to find a new supervisor, particularly if you're in a graduate program. I mean, it's just not that easy. So it's just, I think, unbelievable how callous this government can be with the lives of so many young people. So I just want to point that out, because there are, like, you know, who cares about the big arms deal? I mean, that's not something that I think many of us may lose sleep over. But I'm certainly really upset at the fact that so many students' lives are basically now in turmoil.
I'm glad you brought that up. That's a really important thing to keep front of mind. Stephanie, we'll end with you. Any predictions or thoughts or flags for our listeners?
Well, I always like to end podcasts on a really depressing note. So I agree with basically the consensus here, which is that, you know, for Canada, this isn't really that big of a deal. But, you know, my fellow podcaster, Craig Forsees, who is at University of Ottawa, he blogged this morning that something really that concerns me, which is that this case doesn't matter so much, but if other states in the international system start to see Canada as the low-hanging fruit, or as he put it, the runt of the litter in terms of states that more autocratic countries can kind of pick on to make points, this is actually really bad news for Canada, because we're in a world now where the United States doesn't really want to defend us anymore. Europe is defending itself and we're increasingly isolated. So this is actually could be a very serious harbinger of things to come for Canada. And it's very Canadian to complain about the United States and, oh, it's a hegemon and, oh, it, you know, it thinks it's the leader of the world. Well, this is what the world looks like without U.S. leadership. And it's really bad for Canada. And I'm concerned that, you know, we've had decades of cuts to our foreign service. We do not have a foreign intelligence service. We are not well prepared to live in this new world. So hopefully there will not be too many more cases like this. Canada can't afford dust ups, but if there are going to be more dust ups, we definitely need to make sure that we have a more robust foreign policy institutions than we do now.
Well, I, for one, am crossing my fingers for our great neighbors to the north.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If our listeners want to learn more about Canada, Canadian politics, and Canadian intelligence, there are two podcasts that our participants run and participate in. One was launched this week. It's called Canada and the World by Open Canada. And another is called a podcast called Intrepid. So if you're interested in these issues and more, tune into those podcasts. I want to say thank you to our participants and have a good day, Canada.
Thanks.
We appreciate it on behalf of our nation.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to our friends from the Great North for coming on the show. If you haven't yet, please give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you've found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.